Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status is the only K-12 data analytics platform designed to turn analysis into engagement. To learn more about how School Status can change your school district, head over to schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, Episode 38, and I'm your host, Nick Ortigo. The Washington, D.C. school chancellor has resigned amid outcries over his daughter's school transfer. We'll discuss if the outrage is fair. And why are tech workers in Silicon Valley choosing to send their kids to a private school that shuns technology? Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. Each week, we cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education. Plus, we speak with a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This week, our guest will talk about working with at-risk students. Hello, everybody. Nick Ortigo here, and I'm joined by teacher extraordinaire Lissa Pruitt and education data expert Russ Davis of School Status. Lissa, how are you doing?
I'm great.
Russ, how's it going with you?
Going great.
Typically, I try on this show not to bring up what I call wedge issues. And when I say a wedge issue, I mean something where everyone's so ingrained, it's almost impossible to convince the other side because you just kind of go round and round. But I feel like we wouldn't be doing our job if we didn't at least talk about this shooting over in Florida and the aftermath that's kind of taken place after it. We're about, gosh, we're almost a week now, I guess, when we're recording this. Mm-hmm. And it feels different. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And of course, you're referring to the Stoneman Douglas High School shooting that mm-hmm. happened on February 14th, in case somebody's been living under a rock. But yeah, I do think it feels different. And it took me a few days to figure out why it felt different. But I think what felt so different was the immediacy of the response by the students. And, you know, I think that this generation often gets a pretty bad, this generation that's in high school kind of gets a bad rap about what are those kids doing. But whether you agree with the politics and or the methods to, curb gun violence in our schools, regardless if you do that, I think the overarching thing that we can take away from this is that these kids are different. They are engaged in a way that other students, and I'm not saying these students are better than other students who have been through this tragedy. I just think it's almost like it stirred up a hornet's nest and it was almost immediate. It's like I get out of my school after having, had this terrible, harrowing experience. And then now I'm getting on front of a camera and I'm going to say my piece about it.
And they're so eloquent.
The way people today have greeted us or not greeted us as acknowledged by Ryan is that we aren't being taken seriously enough. Now, I personally don't know the steps that we're going to have to take, but once we figure that out, we're going to take them, and you better believe we're going to take them as soon as possible. Because although we are just kids, we understand. We know. We are old enough to understand financial responsibilities. We are old enough to understand why a senator cares about re-election or not. We are old enough to understand why someone might want to discredit us for their own political purposes. But we will not be silenced. It has gone on long enough that we, just because we are kids, we are not allowed to understand. But trust me, I understand. I was in a closet, locked for 4 hours. I understand what it's like to text my parents, goodbye, I might never ever get to see you again, I love you. I understand what it's like to fear for your life. And I don't think we should ever be discredited because of that. I don't think we should ever be silenced because we are just children. I feel like that is powerful, and it is one of the only reasons this movement is where it is right now.
Like, it's remarkable. They phrase things better than I often could even come up with in my mind. It's pretty impressive.
It really is, and it's so good that some folks, crazy people, think that they're like actors. You know what I mean? Like they're some sort
of. Yeah, I've
like
heard it's, that they were given scripts. I mean, not that that's true. I'm just saying that's what people are trying to say.
Right. We're gonna have to listen to these kids, right? Because they've been through something that is traumatic and terrible. And I don't care if they're reading from talking points, frankly. They have a right to say what they want to say. And I think it's a great exercise in the First Amendment. There's a lot of emotion, obviously. And let me tell you, if somebody took a shot at me or somebody took a shot at my friends or my kid, emotion would not be the word that would begin to describe how I would feel, I'm sure. I can't, you know, I can certainly empathize with their position. And I hope that they're able to affect some change, regardless of what that looks like. I think it's important that we address these systemic issues in our country.
You talked about just being an exercise of the First Amendment. It seems like at least they have the legislators' ears and Congress's ears.
But do they, Nick? Let's. I don't.
They all show up. They all showed up for, you know, when, if you have Rubio and Trump sitting in these town hall type meetings with cameras rolling, they at least have their attention. And I don't care where you are in politics. If you listen to that, if you were in the room and these kids and these parents are saying this to you, it has to have an effect. How far?
I agree with you. I agree with you. There were Democrats and Republicans in that room. And honestly, they're doing their job, right? They're doing what they should have been doing for the past 20 years since Columbine, right? Listening to what people say. I've read a lot of commentary about folks giving these politicians credits for being in the room. I'm sorry, guys. This is actually what you're paid to do. You're paid to listen. And I think that it's a kind of a commentary on our political system right now that it takes something such as this to bring people on both sides of the aisle to the table.
One disappointing thing I have kind of seen is apparently there's a walkout scheduled, I think, just kind of whether or not it's going to take place in Florida only or nationwide. But I saw one Texas school district was actually kind of threatening to suspend students if they participated. And to me, I get it. You don't want disruptions. But this does seem like somewhat of a worthy cause and something that's a good exercise in the First Amendment and in being active. And the fact that a high school would squash that, I think, is kind of the wrong move.
I think it is, too. And the Supreme Court has ruled, obviously, that your First Amendment rights don't end at the schoolhouse gates. But they also have opined that, you know, the school district does have the ability to set policies and enforce those policies. I got to be honest, if I have a child that wants to walk out and there's a 3-day suspension looming over their head, they're going to be at home for 3 days if they want to do it.
Yeah, and that's the Needville Independent School District over in Texas, and they're saying they'll suspend their students for 3 days if they decide to act on this.
3 days seems steep, frankly.
Yeah, it does.
Well, their statement was, we will not tolerate disruption, but you know, that's exactly what happened in Florida. I mean, if that isn't a disruption of life in the center of the community and the school day, then what is? All of us across the nation, we watch these things happen and we grab our chest and we think, oh my gosh, that's so awful. That is so awful. But if we're really honest with ourselves, we're removed from it. As much as we care, as much as it upsets us and scares us to death,
It's not us.
Mm-hmm. And I think what happened is this community is one of the safest communities, great, you know, community. It never was them, and now it's them. And so these students are like, you know what? This is us. This is part of us. This happened to us. It didn't happen to you guys. It happened to us, and we have something to say, and it's valid. You know, I have two boys, a 12-year-old and a 17-year-old, and we were discussing it the other night at dinner, and they were telling me about their plan, you know, how every school has an emergency plan. And so the plan is, you know, to lock the door, to move to one side of the room, to flip the table. So they have plans. So these boys volunteer to be the ones to flip the table. The boys volunteer to be the one to blah, blah, blah. So I told them about a story, you know, that has been presented to me many times in, you know, professional development and safety training in schools. And it's a story of a mother having the same conversation that I was having with my boys. And her young third grade son is telling her, I'm the one that goes to lock the door. I'm the one that me and my friend, we flip the table and everyone gets behind us. So she immediately says, why? Why are you the one that, you know, why did they pick you to do that? You know, why don't you get behind everybody? Why do you have to be the one out in front? And the boy says to his mother, because I volunteered. Because I would do anything to save my friends. I would rather die trying to save everybody than die watching someone try to save me.
Yeah.
And these children live through this. These kids, when they watch it every time, They, and when they do their safety drills, they're going through, what would I do?
Right.
What would I do?
Right.
They're asked to think through, what would you do in this emergency? They're asked to make a plan, but then afterwards, they're not allowed to talk about it. You know?
But yeah. What a terrible thing, right?
Like, right.
Like, why are we there?
Right.
Like, what a country. Like, right. How this is embarrassing to me as a citizen of our country. This embarrasses me and frightens me as a parent. Like, this is ridiculous. And the fact that people will throw up their hands and say, well, that person's crazy. We really can't do anything about crazy people. Let's move on. Nothing to see here. That's nuts. I think that there is a solution to this. I don't think it's necessarily one side's opinion to it. I think it's going to be a blend of both.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to make it, you know, happen. But at some point, we have to address this issue or students are going to keep dying. And at some point, you have to say, if you don't do anything about it, as many crocodile tears as you shed, you just don't care, right? You show caring by action. And I don't know. I feel very heated about this because I'm just tired of seeing it. I'm tired of seeing it on my television. I'm tired of our kids having to – that affects a child psychologically to have to wonder, am I going to get shot on this day because I locked the door to save my friends? It's a noble thing. But it's not something that a child at any age should have to worry about. It's not something any adult should have to worry about. And it's an epidemic that is largely confined to our country. And that's crazy.
Yeah.
Right. And it's an after reaction. It's not a proactive reaction. And all they're asking for is proactive action. You know, yes, obviously, if that does happen, then these are the actions that follow. But, you know, it's time to get in front.
It's in this country, it's so easy for us to be distracted and get off subject. Mm-hmm. And I hope everyone stays on this issue and continues to have a discussion about it. We can't be like the dog and up where it's like squirrel. And, you know, next thing you know, we're onto something else. And so anyhow, Lissa, why don't we go ahead and jump into the teacher's lounge?
Okay, D.C. public schools are back in the news. We actually talked about them a little bit with Ballou High School and the graduation rate. It's, you know, just startling. Well, they're back in the news because Chancellor Antoine Wilson has been asked to step down. He just has been in this role for a year.
Right. And he's apparently good at his job.
Great, yeah. I mean, I have to say, I mean, I've watched many of his speeches. If you want to Google him, you know, he's on YouTube. But he was dismissed because after a year of, in his new position, he decided to move his child to a different high school within his area.
Right.
So one highly performing high school to another. And that was, you know, made him lose the trust of the community. I should point out, there are like over 600 kids on the waiting list to be entered into this high school that he moved his child to.
Mm-hmm.
He himself, a year ago, said, we're not going to honor movements, you know, or, you know, putting kids ahead of the line because the chancellor before him apparently had honored some movements made of children of elected officials and higher-ups, maybe not in the school district, you know, but people outside of the school district just getting their children moved to the front of the line for acceptance. So he has been asked to step aside from the mayor that recruited him and really thought he would be excellent and maybe he is excellent, has been asked to move aside
because of this outcry.
Because they feel like that he kind of illegally or used his power to push his own child ahead of the line to move to a school. Now, he personally spoke out and said, you know, this is a personal issue within my family. My child has been acting different, has fallen in with some people that we needed to separate her from, and she's acting like we've never seen her before, you know, which is delicate, you know.
Yeah. Is this child still within the school district?
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same school district, just different school, performing school.
Both are high-performing schools. So I will say this. A year ago, he had been recruited, or over a year ago, they very well could have said, hey, part of your recruitment, there's this school that has over 600 kids waiting to get into it. We're going to, if you come and work here, you get to have your child go to that school. Mm-hmm. It is, I'm sure Russ will agree, among school districts all over the nation, if you work for a school, you know, you may not live in that district, but your child gets to go to that school because you work for that school. There are very little perks working in the education system, and that is kind of one of them, you know. But what he did is he moved his child from one school to another. They say he kind of broke ranks.
Where I am, and we'll let Russ chime in a second here, but I just don't feel like this guy should be penalized for moving his child.
I would have gotten fired too. That's the truth, right? And I think that is just an example of when it's your child, you will throw wanton disregard for the situation and caution to the wind, right? When it's your baby, it is really like it's not an experiment. It's not this isn't a test tube. We're not running an experiment. It's your child. Mm-hmm. And if you have the ability to make their experience better, then you probably will. And so I probably think that the optics in the District of Columbia are just really bad for doing this. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are a lot of people on the waiting list. And to your thoughts, Lissa, there probably are teachers in the school district who have their kids on that waiting list too. And the optics are just bad, right? If there's a waiting list ahead of them where you know, all the teachers, parents, like they get like to jump the line or something like that. And he puts her at the bottom of that list. That's fine. But I would have gotten fired too, frankly. I mean, I would have made the same call. I'm not saying it's the right call, but when it's your child, how do you not make that call is my question.
We did an interview, and Russ, I know you like this one. It was Personalized Learning, Episode 12, with a superintendent, Jeff Dillon, out of Wilder, Idaho. And he was a principal in that district. And he pulled his kids out of the district because he felt like the school district wasn't providing the education that was necessary for his kids. Mm-hmm. Pulled them out, and it was a little controversial. He eventually worked his way up to superintendent of the district, and he turned the district around, and part of the way was through personalized learning. But that's a great story. I mean, yeah, he pulled his kids out, but it's also a reflection of what the district is up against and the fact that there needs to be change.
Any other profession, you know, if you work at this place and you choose to, whatever you choose to send your children to do for an after school activity or this or that or the other, it doesn't change or affect the job that you're doing every day. Mm-hmm. And so it is a shame when teachers, their job blurs with their children, and that's just how it has to be. You know, it is a shame. You should, if you're excellent at your job and you're doing your job, it shouldn't matter where your child goes to school. It shouldn't matter because that has nothing to do with you doing your job.
The thing that he broke that's really tough to break in a school district and be successful or continue to be successful is he broke the sense of fairness.
Yeah,
right?
And that's true. That's true.
There's a sense of equity in education and fairness. And, you know, think like in a private company like this company, sometimes things aren't fair, right? We try to make them fair, but sometimes I go, it's not fair. And I realize that. And that's just the way it is. Superintendents really don't have that luxury because there is an inherent sense of fairness and, you know, a sense of equality within a school district that he broke. And, you know, and especially in the District of Columbia, you know, their school system is under a spotlight that most school districts are not under. And, you know, a lot of the appropriations in D.C. are appropriated by Congress. I mean, it's just the optics are really, really bad. And you just can't do that and probably keep your job there. You could probably do it in some other school district, but you can't do it in D.C., obviously.
Right. And the mayor that recruited him has, you know, gone on saying, you know, gosh, I hate this, you know, because it, you know, we really wanted him and he really is doing a great job. But because we are under a microscope, you know, we have to be truly transparent. We have to make sure that we're checking every box, and we hate that. But my point, I just want to throw it out there, is that when he was recruited, if they had said when he was recruited from Oakland, California, hey, guess what? If you come here, we're going to let your daughter skip the line and she'll be at this school. Nobody would have batted an eye. Yeah. Nobody. They would have been like, that's fine. We just want him. We need him.
But that's not the deal he made.
Nope. No. It's not.
It's not the deal he made.
Well, speaking of California, Russ, I know you've been kind of monitoring a pretty interesting story off the West Coast out there.
Actually, I found an article in Business Insider that was talking about tech workers in Silicon Valley sending their kids to a private school. That's $28,000 a year, by the way, that shuns technology. So the people that work on your Google browser and your iPhone and that sort of thing some of them, I won't say a lot of them, but some of them are sending their kids to a school that doesn't use computers in the classroom.
This is interesting.
Because they think that screen addiction is a real problem and a real thing. And although this is, again, like our previous article, separating your job from your kids, they're able to separate their job, right, from their kids and saying that, yeah, I may build these things, but I don't agree that kids should be using them on a regular basis. I don't know if you guys have looked around recently, and we've talked about this on our Nick and I use the Moment app, which Lissa has conspicuously not installed.
Whatever. I've installed it. Y'all just don't want to hear my report.
Oh, yeah. What you got? Pull it up. I've already got mine open. I thought I was going to be able to drop below 4 hours a day. I have failed. I just can't do it. I cannot get below 4 hours a day.
Yesterday, I was 2 hours and 49 minutes.
Are y'all want today?
That's really good, Russ. Were you staring at a computer the whole day instead of your phone?
No, no. I was actually flying, so I was staring at my iPad instead.
What do y'all want? Gotcha. What do you want?
Just like, what's kind of like an average for you?
I'm seeing 1 hour and 20 minutes, 1 hour and 15 minutes.
You're such a loser.
No, that's the thing. I've reported this before, and y'all are just always like, ugh.
I applaud you.
Yeah, like that. I think it is. And I think that, you know.
So wait, did these guys lose their job because they're.
No.
I was just asking, Russ. I'm sorry. I just wanted to know if these guys lost their job because they're actually low-key.
They have to pay the tuition of $28,000.
$28,000.
Right.
That's going to work itself out really quick.
But choosing for their children to go to a school where they feel like it meets their personal concerns for their children better, is their job at stake?
You're being facetious.
I'm just asking.
So the school is called the Basis Independent Silicon Valley. It's a 5-12 school. Like I said, it's about 28K a year. Laptops are existent, but they're pretty sparse. They write down their homework assignments and grades in journals called communications journals. It's a really interesting article. We'll include the link in the show notes.
Sure.
But it really goes into a lot of studies that talk about how these devices are, in fact, they're opined to be harmful in children. And I got to be honest, it's a personal decision for every parent, but it is really easy whenever you have a young child to hand them a device because, frankly, they're quiet, right? But you really have to question, you know, is that the best decision? What is that doing for them developmentally? Because students do not learn by staring at a screen. They learn by human interaction. And study after study after study has taught us that. And so, you know, it's okay if you use it sparingly and use it in a way that you go over it, read to them, and that sort of thing. But there isn't an app alive that's going to teach your kids to read by just opening the app and handing it to them. It just doesn't work like that. Humans learn from other humans, not from devices. So I know that Amazon has some tools that could actually limit FaceTime completely, right? So the device will actually lock. I know Nintendo on the Switch has an app on your iPhone that lets you kind of determine how much time a student, a child can have.
Yeah.
And so it really limits their FaceTime because the device isn't very useful if they can't do anything with it. I don't know that Apple has anything like that physically won't let them sign into the device, but I know the Amazon devices work like that.
I do know lots of parents that they do limit it. Like it is like, you know, this is your hour and you may do it during this hour, that kind of thing. But yeah, obviously there's apps and things that can notify you. I know parents in the summertime, you know, when their children are home a lot throughout the day, that they have a list of chores and activities and things that they have to do. And once they have done those things, then they can contact their parent to get the Wi-Fi password. The Wi-Fi password changes every day, and right. You don't get the Wi-Fi password.
That's funny.
Eero is really cool. Like some of these built-in Wi-Fi systems, you just slide it, and it just turns it off. Like they can still get on the network, but they can go nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
which I think is pretty neat.
So are you guys ready for the bright idea?
What
absolutely.
You don't even know what it is yet. Yeah. We are talking
I'm excited about all the bright ideas, Nick.
Oh, that's good. Sorry.
Thank you, Russ. We are going to talk to a teacher out of Nevada. He's been teaching for over 30 years, but he has worked with a lot of at-risk students. So, and in this case, a lot of them, a lot of language barriers. And even one really touching story that you just need to stay tuned for.
Let's hear it.
Our guest in today's Bright Idea segment taught upper elementary for over 30 years, and he now facilitates STEM education for teachers and administrators for six counties in Nevada. Brian Crosby is also running the Learning is Messy blog, which you can find at learningismessy.com. And Brian has been interviewed about innovative teaching and learning by the New York Times and Brian Williams. So we are excited to have Mr. Brian Crosby on the show. Welcome.
Hey, Nick. Great to be here.
Now, I feel like I could talk to you about 100 different topics with all your experience, but the main reason we invited you on is because I know that you have a lot of experience teaching at-risk students in the communities that you've taught in. What makes a lot of your past students at risk?
It can be a combination of things, and in my case it was. Students of poverty, students with real language issues. What we found was a lot of our students... Mostly Hispanic, but you know, Filipino and from different parts of Asia and whatever. Oftentimes, they weren't really solid in any language. Everybody just assumed that, oh, they speak Spanish fluently. Well, over the years, you finally came to realize that really they don't have Spanish fluently either. In fact, that came out glaringly in a project we did once where we used to do a thing where in fourth grade, you tend to study your state's history. And so we had put together a thing on our state, and each group in my class had a different topic. Mm-hmm. One was the, because mining's such a big deal in Nevada, one was a mining group, and one was Nevada history, and so forth. What I challenged them to do was to do it in English and then turn right around and do it in Spanish.
Wow.
And what happened was, I've forgotten this part, we had actually moved some kids around because I asked, how many of you think you could handle that Spanish? And, at least half the kids in my class hands went up. So I said, great. So we kind of evened that out. Well, we hadn't spent 15 minutes on that when kids were crying, Ms. Crosby, I can't do it. I thought my Spanish was better, but I don't know how to say this in Spanish, and I don't know the right wording. And so when push came to shove, it came down to really there were two students in the whole class that could do that. And so we spent just a little bit extra time, and they went around and helped out. And we did that, and it was a really awesome experience.
How intimidating was that for you? If you kind of take back to the first time that you had to broach working with these students that just aren't maybe on a level playing field, and what would you say to, new teachers that find themselves in that scenario?
At-risk students, one of their biggest deficits is experience and schema for the world. And so, we, through the whole No Child Left Behind era, we've gone to limiting students to language arts and math to a certain degree and whatever, and cutting out the things that build schema, like science and engineering and social studies and art and all those pieces. And so it also cuts out the things that are intriguing to a lot of students. And you break through with a lot of students that otherwise aren't all that excited about being in school when you're doing lots of different things and you're learning about lots of different curriculums and, again, bringing in the arts and science and whatever, and you pick up a lot more kids and get them interested, and then all of a sudden, they want to have the language to share that. And so it's amazing how instead of me having to push them to find the words to explain something, they'd come up and ask me questions, and, all of a sudden we had to do lessons on using a thesaurus, and don't just pick any word that you see there because it might not really mean what you think. And so, ask for clarification on some of that. And they'd realize that they didn't want to sound like, because lots of times we'd be video conferencing or podcasting or whatever with students that, English was their very first language and they were very adept at it. And so they didn't want that to come across. They wanted to sound as smart as anybody else. And boy, did that pay off.
When you're dealing with students who, like you said, maybe their parents are working at night, or maybe there's a language barrier that's pretty tough between parents and a teacher, what can you do to communicate with parents in those situations?
I used to have my students come to parent-teacher conferences, and it was a requirement. And I'd have the student help run the run the parent conference and show them work they'd done and you know, share what they thought their strengths were and et cetera. And by doing that, we'd also get into conversations about how we could communicate, because some of them, you're right, I mean, they spoke almost no English. And so even if you could email them, which again, most of them didn't have that source at home, you know, that was difficult. So we'd work things out. Sometimes it was through an older brother or sister that was very bilingual, or an aunt or somebody like that, that you would learn that you could contact. I mean, setting up those communications pieces is really important. And we could tell it paid off, because over time, as we do stuff, parents would show up at school after school because they wanted to see the science thing we were doing, or the social studies project we had up on the walls, or
that's really cool,
or something with math. And so it's amazing. And we'd get contacted by somebody's grandmother in Florida or the Philippines or town in Mexico, because of, and they'd leave comments on their, because each one of my students had their own blog. And so, you know, you just can't say too much about that.
Is there a moment or a story or an interaction with a student where you really realize that you had a winning method? That's something that kind of stands out in your mind?
Well, I've got a bunch of those, but one that I share lots of times when I'm working with teachers on why they might want to blog is I got a new student about the fifth day of school, and she spoke absolutely not a word of English. I mean, not even hello or anything. And so, you know, you hand her a laptop that's going to be hers to use in class, and we started blogging. And so she was doing all of hers in Spanish, which was fine. And so that went on for probably a month or so. And then as her English got better, whenever she could grab a teacher that pushed in to help the second language learners, anytime she could get her to sit down with her and translate her post into English, she would do that. So when you go back and look at her blog, it's all in Spanish. And mm-hmm. then all of a sudden, it's here or there, it starts to be in English and Spanish. And then there'll be a post that's all in Spanish, and then a post that's all in English. And then by the end of that year, everything was in English. And
wow, and you can actually just see that whole transfer.
So yeah, it's a great piece to show teachers, because they can, like, whoa, and how many posts she had. And I think I had her for 2 years. So I think I got her in fifth grade, and I think she had over 80 posts by, you know, the end of sixth grade. So
I know there's another story that you share sometimes about having being told that you were going to have a student, but that wasn't going to be in your classroom, right?
That's absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's just the way, and the fact that the students designed that video that's, I know it's got over 2 million downloads now off the web.
But for those of that don't know what we're talking about, why don't you tell
me
the story.
So I got called down to the office one morning about 15 minutes before school's going to start. And when you're getting called down to the office right before school, it usually means you're getting a new student. And so I wasn't supposed to get a new student, because I had three more students in my class than the other two fourth grades. And so I get down there, and the secretary literally says to me, well, you're getting a new student, but don't worry, because you're never going to see her. And I said, what? She says, well, yeah, she's technically homeless, and she's moved in with her grandfather, and she has leukemia, and so she's undergoing chemo, and so she can't come to school because her immune system is shot. So I had just had experiences over that summer before this happened with Skype in its early stages. And so, I mean, it just dawned on me that second that, wait a minute, we could bring her right into class. You know, we started to look into that. Somebody donated a Mac computer for her in her home, and eventually we got the phone company, who said they never put in free lines, but they did. They put a line That's into cool. her home. We got her online, and so we Skyped her into class. You know, most days. I think it was Thursday. She did chemo, and so she was only able to come in part of that day, and then Friday she was usually not feeling good after the chemo. And so, that was just an awesome experience. And then about a month left in the school year, she was able to come back to school. And so she just walked in. She knew everything, you know, because she worked in it. She was used to working in a group because the kids would just turn her the laptop she was on around, and her head showed up on the laptop about the same size as everybody else's. So she was used to how we did things.
Yeah, I mean, it was as if she was, if you look at the video, I mean, she's basically just a computer, but it's a pupil. Yeah, it's a pupil, yeah, in the classroom. And
it was awesome. And then that we'd get contacted by people. We got contacted by a school in Singapore once because they had a kid that was a paraplegic and couldn't go up the stairs to their math class. And you know, would that work? And I used to get called by either parents that wanted that same thing for their kid at their school and the school was balking, or the other way, the school wanted to do it and the parents were worried about it. And so sometimes I'd have conversations to, you know, talk about, you know, what the technology really does and doesn't do, and that not everybody in the world's going to be able to watch, or, you know, whatever.
And what year was that when that took place?
Wow, 2007?
So I have to applaud you, because 2007, I think if everybody listening kind of rolls back in their mind, you know, this wasn't when you had FaceTime on your phone. It wasn't as obvious that you could do
right.
this. And so there you recognize the technology and said, you know what, we can make this happen.
Yes.
That's really great.
Exactly.
Well, again, Brian Crosby, you can keep up with him on the learningismessy.com website, but also just a great person to kind of hop online and Google it and check out some of the TED Talks he's given, as well as the other videos out there from all the work you've done in your great 30-year career. We appreciate you joining us. Are you ready for our pop quiz?
I am.
All right. First question. If students could only go to school for one subject, which subject should it be?
Oh, wow. I mean, based on what we were just talking about, I'd like to say science or STEM so that they understand how things work, but I'd probably default to language, language arts, knowing how to share information. You know, I hate cutting out math, but that's a tough call.
Yeah. What are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching?
Oh, wow, this is an easy one. You know, collaboration and skills, you know, knowing how to work with others. That's one of the things I was always known for when I was still in the classroom, was I'd spend, and I have to give a principal at that time some kudos for that, because she used to tell us at the beginning of every year, take 3 to 6 weeks to get that, build that chemistry in your classroom and how to do school in your classroom and work together and whatever. So we used to spend a lot of time with that. Kids actually role-playing what to do if somebody's off track in their group and whatever. So, you know, all those collaboration skills of, and to teach them, like I said, explicitly, you know, respect and patience and asking questions. I used to have a rule in my classroom that nobody in the group could ask a question until everybody in the group had the same question. Mm. Because oftentimes kids would waste time getting up and maybe you're helping somebody else and they're standing there waiting to ask you a question. And if all they'd said was, can we do this in pencil? Somebody in their group could have said, yeah.
Right.
And they'd still be working, right? So I think that's a really important piece, just that whole active learning piece.
What does every child deserve?
I think a really broad and rich curriculum, you know, get away from this narrowed curriculum piece that we've been doing too long.
What's the biggest challenge for today's educators?
Too much meddling from outside by people that think they know what is involved in teaching because they were in school. You know, too many programmed approaches that take the teacher out of the equation.
What's the best gift to give an educator?
I think a lot of them would probably say a Starbucks card, but I think respect, you know, coming and finding out what's really going on instead of assuming they know from comments made by students or, you know, even other parents that are having an issue or whatever, but just really respect educators.
Which teacher changed your life?
Oh, wow. Well, I guess one was Mr. Ford, who was a history teacher when I was in middle school. I had him for 2 years, and he did that whole storytelling part, and the respect he had, and you know, how he talked to kids and let them and taught them how to interact with each other. I think I learned a lot from that.
And last question, pen or pencil?
Well, I guess I'd have to say pencil, but I'd also say a device. Because one of the things that really came out to me when I started doing one-to-one is how many students that have crummy handwriting would write more because all of a sudden handwriting wasn't an issue. Their handwriting looked as good as anybody else's because it was typed out on the computer. And so
that's certainly, handwriting's certainly a problem of mine. Brian yeah. Crosby, again, we appreciate you joining us on the Class Dismissed podcast.
All right. It was great to be here. Thanks.
Thank you. That's going to do it for this episode of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or a comment, remember you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So if you like what you heard today, please be sure and hit that subscribe button, and we'd also love it if you'd leave us a 5-star review. Don't forget you can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast or on Twitter. Just search for us by typing in Class Dismissed. On behalf of Russ with School Status and Lissa representing all the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortega, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed.